Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we're speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We'll be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Dr. Lindsay Bottoms. Dr. Lindsay is a senior lecturer in exercise physiology at Hertfordshire University and is currently the research lead for sport, health, and exercise. She's on the board of the American College of Sports Medicine Combat Sports Special Interest Group and is a former elite level fencer. In this episode, we discuss the lesser known combat sport of fencing and its unique nutritional requirements, as well as Dr. Lindsay's research into carbohydrate mouth rinsing, fluid balance, and tart cherry juice. There's a lot to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Now, we're going back overseas again today, back to one of our favorite and one of the countries that's given us the most guests on the Fight Science Podcast, back to England. So we've got Dr. Lindsay Bottoms joining us today. Lindsay, thanks so much for coming on.
That's okay.
Of course. Now, Lindsay, we've just come in off the back of the ACSM annual meeting. There's a ACSM special combat sports interest group. And you were part of the chair with Dr. Reid Wirial and Mark Germain on there. Lindsay, I guess first question, how did you get to be involved with that? How did that all come to be?
So I don't know how many years ago it is now, but I went to the American College of Sports Medicine annual meeting. And you look at the interest groups, and I went along to the combat sports one. And at the time, it was Laura DeRay that was the main chair. And they were needing some more help and more people to get involved. And so I decided to volunteer. So I don't know, that was 6-7 years ago now. So I've just done it ever since, really.
Yeah, yeah. And it's such a great group, eh? Such a great source of information, especially on the Facebook page, and everyone shares their research. I was talking to Reid about it, and I just do the time differences, couldn't get onto the online webinar. But Reid was telling me there was over 400 people participating.
Yeah, so we had a lot of people sign up, yeah. So, and then what we've done now is we've made the talks available online as well. So I think we've had a massive interest. So it's definitely something we're going to do again because of the numbers that people have signed up to it.
In the 6 years since you've been involved, Lindsay, have you seen that? Have you seen a growing interest in combat sports science?
It's difficult to say because this is the first time we've done this sort of thing. So, and I think what we normally do is at the conference, you have like a meeting, and anyone at the conference who's interested in combat sports can go along to that meeting. But obviously you've already diluted the numbers because they've got to be ACSM members. They've got to be obviously at the conference. So, we found that the numbers were always sort of around sort of 20 to 30 people that attended those sort of meetings. Yeah, I think in recent years, when you see the amount of research that's been produced, I do think combat sports is getting bigger. And having done this online thing, it just shows there is a massive interest out there. So I do think it's growing. But as I said, from our perspective as ACM, it's a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's wind it back a little bit. And let's talk about how you came to be working in that space from the get-go.
So the reason I work in combat sports... So the combat sport that I'm most interested in, which is a bit different to your some of the ones that you've probably looked at within your podcast, is fencing. So when I was a child, so I actually did karate first. So I did Shotokan karate, and I got my black belt when I was 12. I think wow. I was one of the youngest people in England at the time to get my black belt. That was back in 1992. I got that, and then I actually decided I wanted to try something different, so I ended up doing a little bit of fencing, basically I sort of did it as a bit of a hobby, and it was only later in life that I decided to take it seriously, and that's when I got really enthusiastic about fencing. I fell in love with it probably in my late 20s, ironically, even though I started so young. Because I was doing it, when I finished my PhD, I didn't know what to research, and so I thought, this is what I love, this is what I want, this is what I do. So I decided to focus my my research in the fencing area, and that's really sort of how I've got into.
Yeah, fencing's an interesting one because I can almost guarantee you that I'd say probably 8 out of 10 people, if you told them, if you went through all the combat sports and you say fencing, they go, what? What, fencing's a combat sport? And you go, yeah, it actually is. Can you talk to us just even like a generic training? How's it look? Like, how does training for fencing look like? What's a training week look like?
It depends on what level you are. I guess that's with any sport. But if you're at the elite level, you're going to do, you'll probably do a couple of sessions or a few sessions a week on sparring. So you're fighting against other people. You'll have your technical and tactical lessons with a coach. So you do one-on-one lessons with a coach. Obviously you've got your S&C, so you've got your weights, your plyometric trainings and all that. So I guess it's probably similar to any other combat sport, to be perfectly honest. You've got a bit of egg for everything that you've got to focus on. But the thing about fencing, it's very, very tactical. So there is a high element of the tactic side of it, and the lessons and that element of it, there's quite a lot.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating to watch. And I was, before getting ready for this episode, I watched quite a few, you call them fights or bouts or whatever you call them. And it's insane. Like, I was sitting there and my jaw kind of hit the floor. I was like, wow, the way you guys move and the footwork. I was sort of reminded of very, very high skilled boxers and the lighter guys' boxers, how light they are on their feet and how well they move.
Yeah, that's often a comparison for footwork is between boxing and fencing, just that footwork, as you say, being light and the speed at which you've got to move. And yeah, they often refer to that.
Yeah, excellent. Can you explain what are the different types of fencing that you can do?
So there's three main weapons. So you've got foil, épée and sabre, and they are quite different. So your foil, you have... Basically, you've got to put a sword and you've got to hit with the tip of the sword. So the very end of the sword, the point. The idea is you're going to hit the opponent with that. It's quite a light blade and it's got quite a small guard at the end. And the target area is actually the whole of the torso. So you'll see in foil that they wear what we call a silver lame. So it's a silver jacket over the white outfit that everyone wears. And the target area is literally just the torso. And the thing with foil, you've got to, this is where fencing gets quite complicated. It's got to be your right of attack. So there's a high tactical element, and you've got to be the one that sort of starts the attack for you to actually count to have a hit. And then in épée, which is the one that I did, it was much more simple. Again, you hit with the point of the blade. You've got a bigger guard this time though on the, so it's a bit of a heavier sword. And you can literally hit anywhere from head to toe. If we hit at the same time, you both get a point. If you hit first and the other one's too late, it's only one light will come up. Only one point is going to be scored. So it's much more simplistic in that. Does make it actually, it makes it more tactical because you've got to try and avoid being hit at the same time as hitting the opponent. And then you've got saber, which is very different. And sabre is probably more what you see in films and then when you see them waving the sword around a bit more. This time with sabre, you actually can hit with any part of the blade. So it's not the tip, it's any part of the blade itself. And the target area is the torso, but also the arms and the head. And you'll see, basically, and there's this right of attack as well, this concept that you've got to be the attacker. So that's sabre. So they are very different. Sabre is much more powerful and it's much quicker. So you'll see the points last a lot less in sabre compared to foil and épée.
This may be a silly question, Lindsay, but are the swords sharp?
No. The épée and foils, they have a little button on the end. So they're quite blunt, but it still hurts. Don't get me wrong. We still come out of it. You'll see a lot of fencers. They're bruised from all over their arms and legs. So it's still painful if it's a quite a hard hit. And in foil, they tend to be a lot bendier. So right. You can almost like, whip. And it used to be that it's not so much anymore because of the timing of it. It used to be that they could sort of whip over the back to get the points. And they can still sometimes do it, depends on how well they do it. But of course, if you've got a beginner trying to do that, you get a massive whiplashes, like whips across. It's really quite painful. The jackets obviously do protect you, but yeah, they're not sharp. They still can be quite painful.
That was going to be my next question, is that how much does the suit do? Because when I was watching it, I was thinking like, wow, they must be producing quite a bit of force going in this and when they hit each other.
So the jackets, if you're doing international level, the jackets have to be 800 newtons, so they can withstand 800 newtons. So they're really thick. So this is actually one of the difficulties, which is where nutrition is quite interesting in terms of fencing, is so thick to protect you from this. It's more in case, I don't know, the problems of fencing, I guess, is when you hit, sometimes the blade can break. So the blades snap, and it does happen quite often. And I guess when they snap, it's making sure that the jacket's thick enough to prevent the blades going through. And that's the main safety concern. So it's not really necessarily protecting you from the bruises, but it's more to do with if the blades break and it means it can't get through the jacket. So yeah, we have, for international fencing, it's 800 meters. If you're just a club fencer, it can be 350. But that's pretty thick, and that brings its own challenges.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue into speaking about the nutritional demands of the sport. And it is, it's quite an interesting sport. How do you go about planning nutrition for it?
So if you go to probably what I would call a club, well, national competitions, you'll find that nutrition is something that people haven't put enough thought into, to be perfectly honest. It's probably the same in a lot of sports, apart from when you get to the elite level. The thing with a fencing competition is it lasts all day. So you go along, it could start at 9 o'clock in the morning. You can do these, what we call pool rounds, where you fence like a round robin thing, where the fights are quite short, but they're about 3 minutes in length, and you have about six fights. Then you have a break, and then you go in, you get seeded off the back of that, and you go into knockout stages until the end of the competition. And you could have, it depends on how many people are in the competition, but you could have some like 8 knockout stages, and they can last 3 minutes on, 1 minute off, 3 minutes on, 1 minute off, 3 minutes on. So it could be about 9 minutes of actual fencing for each of those knockout rounds. You can find yourself leaving the competition venue at 8 in the evening. So it's a whole day. So the difficulty is you don't know often when you're going to be fencing and when you're not. And obviously it's that whole day of trying to feed yourself and getting enough nutrition, but not overeating, not getting too many spikes in glucose. So it's quite a complex one. But the hydration is a difficult one, because obviously we sweat a lot before the kit. So
That was going to be my next question. Obviously, if you've got those big kits on, you must be perspirating quite a lot in there.
Yeah, so it's something that hasn't been researched enough in fencing. I've actually got a PhD student that's been looking at it at the moment. So we need to get some of the data out there. But you do sweat a heck of a lot. So, but actually naturally fencers, I think, in that regard, do drink quite a lot of fluid. So, but you're probably losing over the day easily sort of 4 liters, if not more, of, and so they're having to drink excessive amounts of fluid throughout the day to keep hydrated. Because it's an intermittent thing, and you are doing fence fights and then resting, fights and resting, you do have time to get your fluid. It's not too bad in that regards. It's just remembering to make sure they remember to.
Yeah. For those match days where you are doing that, where you're doing the 3 minute on, 1 minute off, and you've got up to those 8 knockout stages that you're going through, what are some of the things you're doing in terms of your nutrition? Like, what are the type of foods or the type of macronutrients that you're prioritizing?
I don't think a lot of people think much about the nutrition side of it. I think it's a lot of it is going to be slow release carbohydrates to try and maintain the fuel and not to have too many spikes. So that's what I would say is mainly. But to be fair, there is really not much out there in nutrition for fencing, and that's something that needs to be changed. I do believe that, because there's a high element of concentration, During fights, I think that's where some of the research that I've done around the carbohydrate comes in, caffeine comes in. I do think there's that element where you can introduce some of that within fights to try and increase concentration, increase reaction times and all that side of it. In terms of the day, it's a balanced diet, really, and probably having the slow-release carbohydrates to keep you fueled during the day.
Yeah, and we were talking a bit offline there, Lindsay, and you told me that the fencing don't actually have the weigh-ins. There's no weigh-ins for fencing. People just rock up and it's more you match based on age and experience. Is that right?
Yeah. So, basically it's you have open competitions. Domestically, that's generally how it happened. It'll be open competitions, so you've got to be 13 years and older to take part in those. You can have, obviously, you've got your cadets, your juniors, your seniors, and then you've got your veterans. So you can do competitions based around those. But even at open competitions, particularly in the UK, anyone can turn up within those age groups as long as they're above 13 years old. So there's no weigh-in. So it's not done off weight or anything like that. If you fit the criteria, you can go along and you fence. And then they look at your rankings and off the back of those rankings, then they'll put you into the certain round robin groups at the beginning, and that's how it starts. Then the rest of the competition is seeded off its own competition.
Yeah, it might be a few other combat sport athletes that are listening to this, Lindsay, that they might think, hey, maybe I'll get into fencing to skip the whole making weight process. But you mentioned it just there, Lindsay, your research into mouth rinsing. We haven't actually spoken about this on the podcast. Before we talk about what you found in your research, can you just go over what the concept of a mouth rinse is?
So the concept of the mouth rinse, so with sport, obviously, if you're doing less than, say, if the duration is probably, less than 45 minutes, you've got enough fuel in your body. So you've got enough carbohydrate stores in your body. You don't necessarily need to replace them. But people have found that if you were to ingest carbohydrate, it can improve performance still. But it's unlikely to be due to the body needing carbohydrate because you do have sufficient stores. So it actually came about back in the early 2000s by a group at Birmingham University. And they actually found that if you were to infuse glucose into the bloodstream, it didn't improve performance. It had very little impact on performance under the hour. But if you were to mouth rinse the carbohydrate, it actually improved performance as much as if you ingested it. So what they realized is that there was something going on in the mouth. And it's almost like there was receptors that detects the carbohydrate and it sort of tells the brain they found now that it affects the prefrontal cortex of the brain. So it improves the sort of motivational side of things and the general well-being sense in the brain. And that's what they found. So that people have started to look at that in terms of performance. So with fencing, again, we're just looking at 3 minute, for the first round, you've got 3 minute bouts. For later on in the competition, you have 3 minutes on, 1 minute off, 3 minutes on, 1 minute off, 3 minutes on. So it's not a really long duration. So again, if you were just to do something like mouth rinsing and it makes you feel better, but you're not necessarily ingesting all the carbohydrates, then potentially it can improve cognitive function, it can improve reaction time, and generally in performance. So that was kind of the thing behind it.
Yeah, can you talk us through, and you completed research looking at that in the athletes, Lindsay?
Yeah, so we've done it within fencing. I've done it within cycling as well. So within cycling, we looked at different durations of mouth rinsing. So literally the idea is you put, and we're talking about something like Lucozade Sport or Gatorade, you know, with the normal sort of 6% carbohydrate. You put it in your mouth for about 25 mils in your mouth for 5 seconds or 10 seconds, and then you spit it out. You can ingest it. So obviously in this scenario, if you're at a competition, you probably just ingest it, especially with the issues of things like the coronavirus. But there is this concept that you are literally activating mouth receptors and it stimulates basically the motivation side of it. We did it within fencing just to see if it was going to have an impact. And it actually had a really positive impact on performance. So we looked at a target area. We basically did an accuracy test So they had 60 seconds to do as many lunges as they could and then hitting a target. And we found that actually improved the accuracy of hitting the target with having the carbohydrate malfeasance after fatiguing exercise. So once you get more tired, then it has an impact on the performance. And that's what we found within fencing. And the other thing with fencing, so at the elite level, it is really tiring and you do want your carbohydrates. But at club level, when there's a lot of sitting around at competition, not everyone's going to get through to the final. And I think a lot of people probably actually overeating calories rather than undereating calories. So it's two different things. You've got the club level and you've got the elite level. The elite level is a different story. But in terms of the club level, I think it was another way as well, trying to get ways that maybe can improve performance without them ingesting lots of calories. And I think it's trying to get that balance as well.
Okay, so it's kind of like the double whammy at the elite level, because they're probably more likely to be actually glycogen depleted from the increased competition. And you want to get the motivation, where maybe not so much with the club level guys.
Yeah, so it's a different, there's different ways to look at it, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you talk to us about your paper where you're investigating the carbohydrate and the electrolyte solution and the fluid balance?
Yeah, so this was research done out in Athens. So I ended up being brought in on the project. Essentially, it was more looking at sort of fencing with, well, we looked at the Greek fencing team. I think it was the Epee team. There were something like 16 fencers, and they looked at how much fluid was actually needed during like a training type session to try and balance out the fluid needed. So it worked out that during a 2-hour training session, about 16 milliliters per kilogram of weight was needed per hour. Anyways, we just looked at that, worked out how much fluid might be needed for a 2-hour session, and then looked at placebo versus a carbohydrate solution just to see if it had any impact on the number of hits scored, number of hits conceded. And basically, in this scenario, it had no effect on these athletes. But this is a bit different to. But we've done some stuff with competitions, and it's a different when you're looking at things like in a training scenario versus a competition scenario. So this was more of a training scenario, but yeah, it had no real impact.
How do you think it would change if it was in that competition scenario?
So we've done some data. So we tried to, because again, there's very little research actually in fencing itself. And this is the problem with combat sports generally. There's less research out there. And the problem is trying to get decent data in competition, isn't it? Because obviously it's trying to be able to collect the heart rates or collect, you know, data. First of all, you've got to get the buy-in from the athletes. But most of all, because it's at competition level, you're not allowed to have all the stuff on. So what we try to do recently in the last few years with my PhD students, create our own competitions to try and get the fencers to be fencing at a level that they would be at competition. So we actually gave monetary prize money to try and, so we tried to stage it. We actually did like a round robin competition, but we only had 8 fencers. But basically we created our pool round and then we created our knockout stages, but they fenced each other as though they're going to the final. We looked at all the points at the end and worked out the winner versus the last person. So each of them got a certain amount of money depending when they came. And they really gave a massive effort. And you can see the data that we got in terms of heart rate was much higher than what we've done previously when we tried to simulate sort of what might be a competition and stuff. Because suddenly they gave everything because they wanted the money. So it does make a huge difference if you're looking at in proper competition versus other things. And the demand is much greater. So it's hard. It's hard because it's difficult to do the research in competition.
Yeah, I'm just thinking. I was as soon as you said that, I thought, I'm going to text one of my business partners and see if we can organize that, because one of my physios is doing his PhD in concussion research. And we were having this exact same discussion. And I never even thought about that. Maybe we can run a mock competition, that'd be great.
But then you have complete control over how it's run, how it's done. But there's got to be an incentive for them, because obviously a normal competition, it's winning, we'll give them points, give them rankings. They don't get that from your competition. So that's why we looked at the monetary side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's also a discussion we have quite a lot in when we talk about combat sports with making weight as well. And I guess it's very difficult to get things past ethics when you're talking about people passively or actively dehydrating. And, you know, there's quite a bit of a debate where people, you know, dehydrate to 3 or 4 or 5%. But then when it comes to competition, you know, if in reality, these, especially in mixed martial arts, if these guys are getting, say, a short notice fight or a 4 or 5 week camp and that's it, the reality is that they're going to have to, you know, passively or actively dehydrate much higher numbers. And it's, you know, how do we represent that in the research so we know how to keep those guys safer? And it's like, you're probably not ever going to be able to do it unless you're doing it in that competition sense. Yeah. So, Dr. Lindsay, let's talk about your research into tart cherry juice. This is another thing we haven't spoken about on the podcast. So I'm going to be a pain and get you to explain what tart cherry juice, what the theory is behind it, and then what you found in your research.
So tart cherries, so that these fruit that have really strong color, they're basically high in something called anthocyanins. And these anthocyanins can work as like what we call an antioxidant, or they can have other actions within the body. And so when you get your, when you've done a really heavy training session and you've got your muscle soreness, often that can be caused by what we call reactive oxygen species within the body. So that can cause some of that soreness. And if you've got things like, if you've eaten, or if you've got antioxidants in the body, it can help prevent some of that soreness. And that's why a lot of people use things like tart cherry juice for recovery. We've done it very much from a health perspective rather than a sport perspective, which is probably why my explanation of it isn't as good as what others might do. But essentially, we've been looking at it in terms of metabolic syndrome people. So people that are overweight, have high blood pressure, may have potential problems with their glucose. And what we're finding with the tart cherry juice is it's actually improving blood pressure, improves their insulin response, and generally it's improving some of their lipid control. So it can actually improve cardiovascular health, really. So we've been doing it from that perspective, but I know there's a big... there's a big area for it in terms of anti-inflammation, like it gets rid of inflammation due to that antioxidant property, and it's good for recovery.
So it could be worth having a couple two of cherry juice after your training or competition.
Yeah, but it's really got to be that concentrated stuff like that you get, yeah.
Yeah, not the Ribena that you get from the office. Okay, last question before I let you go, Lindsay. We're actually running season 4 of this podcast in conjunction and side by side with a gut health series that we're running as well. And we're getting a lot of gut health experts to come on. And you've got a very unique perspective and experience with this in that you have Crohn's disease. And can you talk to us, I guess, explain to the people at home, what is Crohn's disease? What's your experience with it? And how would you suggest that athletes who do have it manage it?
That's a big question. So basically, Crohn's disease is part of what we call inflammatory bowel disease. So inflammatory bowel disease is an autoimmune disease that causes inflammation in your digestive tract. So Crohn's can basically be anywhere from the mouth to the anus. So it can be anywhere in your digestive tract. Ulcerative colitis is the other big inflammatory bowel disease, and that is really in your large intestines. So I've got Crohn's, and actually the most common place is around the terminal ileum where you get inflammation. So essentially your immune system's getting overactive, causing inflammation in your digestive system. And then, so you have to have immunosuppressants usually to calm it down. But of course it keeps coming back, and so you end up getting a lot of scar tissue with it as well. So as I said, mine was around that terminal ileum. I got diagnosed with it in 1994. So it's a long time ago now. And I ended up with a lot of scar tissue around mine. So I had a lot of inflammation, and then it kept coming down because I reacted really well to steroids. So if I was given steroids, that inflammation went away. I've had every immunosuppressant under the sun. I've had problems with the immunosuppressants. I'm thankfully medication free now. But that's only because I had... I had to have a large chunk of my bowel taken out back in 2012. Because of all that scar tissue that I was getting, it was causing it to get more and more narrow. So in terms of eating for sport, it's actually very difficult, because back then when I had a lot of scar tissue, I struggled to eat high fiber food. So I had to eat a lot of easy digestible food. So of course, your simple carbohydrates, which if you're trying to do a competition of some kind, it's quite hard because you've not got that slow release of carbohydrate. I tended to have to eat the simple carbs. So that was, it's quite a challenge when you've got something like inflammatory bowel disease. It's different from person to person, but because of that scar tissue, that was something that I really struggled with. But yeah, I was really lucky. I had a bowel resection in 2012. It took me a long time to make that decision. Because I kept getting very ill, and yes, I kept getting hospitalized, but actually in between hospitalization, I was actually okay. So I was still training, still competing. And it was only, I think when I started reacting badly to the immunosuppressants. So again, with people with inflammatory bowel disease, often they end up having to either have intravenous immunosuppressants or you have to inject them. So I was injecting them. And I started losing my hair. I started having all sorts of other problems, and I was struggling to train and cope with that in the end. So I decided that I had enough medication. I was going to have the surgery. It was 3 years until my next Commonwealth Championships, which is what I was trying to get to with my fencing. And so, yeah, I had a bowel resection. I had that bit with all the scar tissue taken out. I had half a meter of my intestine taken out. And I've been medication free actually since then. But my biggest fear was that I was going to need a stoma. And of course, trying to do combat sport with a stoma was always going to be a challenge. So when I went into my surgery, I just pleaded with the surgeons to only do that if it was absolutely like the only thing they could do. They said at the time they probably should have given me a stoma with the amount that they took out. But because I went in quite fit, they gave me the benefit of the doubt. And it took me a long time to recover post-surgery. My digestive system wouldn't work for quite a while. But then it kicked in and that's it. It's been great. I've been really good ever since. It's a challenge because now the problem is with people with inflammatory bowel disease is the toilet. So if you're competing, you're always, or anything really, it can be difficult. A toilet nearby is always useful. It's probably quite good for making weight. it's been great for me. It's worked really well. I do think my metabolism, I don't absorb things as quickly or as easily as other people, so I think I can get away with eating more because I've got to get more calories in because I don't absorb it all. So that's my experience of it. In terms of athletes, how they manage it is one of these diseases that's different from person to person. Nutrition though is critical. So it's really working with a dietitian. If you're doing it at an elite level, it has to be with a dietitian. As I said, some people struggle with the fiber content. Some people don't. Some people will struggle. So a lot of people now go onto the FODMAP diet with inflammatory bowel disease, so, you know, low fermenting foods. It's really one of these things that people have to play around with the foods themselves to see what aggravates it. I would always have a food diary. I give all this advice. I did none of it. But if you were to be an elite athlete, I would say you've got to do a food diary and work out really what's aggravating it and what's not. And you will find things. Some things help and some things don't. Even things like the cherry juice, where it's anti-inflammatory, potentially, I want to look at it in terms of ulcerative colitis because, you've got an inflammatory disease, having foods that are anti-inflammatory surely must be beneficial. I think the other thing is fatigue. One of the biggest problems with inflammatory bowel disease is fatigue, and it's listening to your body really. There's some days where even when I felt fine and I would go to train, I could barely lift. You know, I'm not going to give how much I used to be able to do, but it wasn't very good. But, you know, if I was squatting or something, I could find that I was squatting a lot less on some days than other days, and there was no explanation for it. So I think sometimes you have to listen and just let you accept that those days you can't train as hard. So I'm not sure that's the best advice, but nutrition is massively important when you've got something like inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And thanks for sharing, Lindsay, because it is. It's the reason I wanted to run this gut health series as well is because I personally am finding a lot more in practice that these bowel issues or gut issues in general are almost becoming more prevalent. Obviously, as our knowledge of them comes along, they're probably getting diagnosed more. But they are, they're quite prevalent, especially in this population. And like you said, there's not a lot of research in combat sports, period, let alone going into how to deal with Crohn's disease with a combat sport athlete. So no, it's always good to hear about people who've gone through and been through the process and come out the other side. But Lindsay, thanks so much for doing that episode. If people are listening to this and they want to get in contact with you, they want to read more about your research, they want to read any of these studies that you spoke about, what's the best way for them to do that and to get in contact with you?
The best way is just to email me, to be fair. So my email is just l.bottoms@hearts.ac.uk, and hearts is H-E-R-T-S. You can, because I have a stupid name, you can just Google me and you'll find me straight away. The university always puts our contact stuff right at the beginning of Google when you search. So yeah, there's only one me. There's not many Lindsay Bottoms out there.
The one and only. All right. Well, Doctor, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time. I know everyone's super busy, but thank you so much. And I'm sure we'll chat again soon.
Cheers. Thanks.
And there it is. Another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Fencing is definitely not for the faint-hearted, and now you can see why. Be sure to keep up to date with Lindsay's work and become a member of the ACSM Combat Sports Special Interest Group if you're interested in staying up to date with the latest evidence in the field. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.